I'm Larry. I'm an alcoholic. I'm actually not speaking for Larry, for AA. I'm speaking as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to share my experience, strength, and hope. I'll get some of the basics out of the way. My sobriety date is March 9th, 1983, which means that I've been doing this for a while. I have a sponsor who I talk to regularly, and I have men that I sponsor that I also talk to regularly. I've had a service commitment since my first time in AA. They handed me a sponge and told me to start washing ashtrays. But I'm going to talk a little bit about my background. I'm the oldest of three. I came from a family that didn't have any alcohol in it. I had never seen my mother or father drink. I didn't have any drinking relatives that I'm aware of. My dad was a career military man, and so we were distant from other family members. But as far as my mom and dad were concerned, they didn't drink. They didn't celebrate holidays. They didn't celebrate anniversaries. They didn't do any of that with alcohol. But because my father was a career military man, I hung around Air Force bases with a lot of people who did drink. And I was fascinated with the idea of drinking. And so when I was 12 years old, we were stationed in England. And I was bagging groceries at the commissary and had probably as much money as some of my little English friends' parents were earning, just because the economies were so screwed up. But anyway, I was doing that and I had the money. And one day, one of my little English friends said that he had to go down to the pub and pick up alcohol for his parents. And I was fascinated with how he could do that. And he said, oh, it's simple, that you go to the pub, they have one of those half doors at the back, and you go around the back and you tell them what you want and you give them the money. And I immediately realized that that was how I was going to get my first drink. And so I took a fistful of money down to the pub with my same two little English running buddies. And I didn't even know what to order. So basically we bought what they were used to buying for their parents. And I'm certain it was ale and schnapps and all that kind of stuff. We bought a bunch and we took it to the local park and we drank it. And that was the first time I had ever drank alcohol. I never tasted it before. And indeed, it was a typical alcoholic experience. I blacked out. I passed out. I got sick. I had to be taken home. You know, people had to tell me the next day what I had done. And then I discovered what became my sort of constant companions, which was shame and remorse. Because none of the things that were being described sounded like things that I would normally do. But unlike others, I couldn't wait to do it again. And indeed, I became a weekend drinker and would go to the pub with or without my friends, buy the quote liquor for my family, and then take it to the park and drink it. And that went on for about a year until my father got transferred. And where he got transferred to was South Carolina. And at that time, South Carolina was a dry state. And there wasn't really anything you could buy to drink. You certainly couldn't steal it out of a grocery store or a liquor store or anything like that. There was moonshine, but you had to have somebody in your family making it before you could drink it. But then I found my lesser companions, and they were drinking something called 190 proof grain alcohol, which it turned out you could buy in a gallon jug at the drugstore. So we'd buy this 190 and then we'd cut it 50-50 and we'd drink it. And needless to say, it was pretty potent stuff. And so me, who had always been a good student and an athlete and everything like that, all of a sudden I was no longer a good student. I didn't have any more interest in playing basketball. I liked what I called partying, and I drank. And I drank through high school. I drank into trouble. I drank into probation officers, I drank into police officers, I drank into ministers, drank into school counselors, all telling me that I was making a real serious mistake. And at one time, my own father even sat me down and said it was his observation that some people could drink and some people couldn't. And I clearly was one of the ones who couldn't. And of course, I did what alcoholics do. I just ignored all the do-gooders and the good advice and thought basically they ought to mind their own business. I graduated from that high school barely in a drunken blackout. I moved to Colorado, and then from there I moved to California. I came to California to pick the money off the trees. That's what we'd been told in South Carolina. You know, this was the golden state. So, and indeed, I got a really good job in a defense plant down on the Central Coast, and I was making pretty good money. And then I realized, I don't know how I even realized it, that I could go to community college. And college had never been something that was available to me because of economics and where I'd gone to high school. So I started going to community college, and I found out I was a really good student and good at it, nothing like having been through high school. And so the night I graduated from this little community college, they had my picture of me holding the big cardboard check with the from the Lions Club for my scholarship. And that was in the local paper. And in the local paper on the back page was about 2 inches of me being arrested that same night for public intoxication and breaking and entering and a bunch of other stuff. And what ended up happening was the Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Department said I should basically relocate. And I did. And I came to San Francisco with my scholarship money. And it was the 60s. And so it was not a time when people were real concerned about people drinking too much or people doing anything too much. I mean, it was sort of like that was the... That was what the 60s were. They were too much. And that's what I did. And about that time, I realized that I needed to, you know, what I was doing was abnormal. And I started trying to fix myself. And it didn't work. I went to encounter groups. I went to counselors. I went to shrinks. And in 1973, to make someone who was my wife then happy, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so in 1973, I went to the same meeting in Oakland at 2910 Telegraph, and I went for a year. And at the end of the year, I went and told that woman who was soon to be an ex-wife that AA wasn't something I wanted to do and I was not going anymore. And so I quit. And then 10 years later, and for people who've heard me before, I got sober with bikers. So I fell in with a group of clean and sober bikers. They were called the Fifth Chapter Motorcycle Club. And I was detoxing myself. I had an anti-abuse prescription from my friendly doc. And I was detoxed and I was dry and I was just crazy as a loon. And I started hanging out with these guys. And eventually, after hanging out with them for a while, they told me that if I wanted to keep hanging out with them, I needed to be a participant in a 12-step program. And being an alcoholic, I said, well, I've already done that, and it doesn't work for me. And them, being other recovering alcoholics, said, we don't really care. That's what you're going to do if you want to hang out with us. Otherwise, beat it. So I started going to AA with a guy named Big John. We went to the Island Fellowship. And, you know, it was nothing like I'd remembered from 1973. There was lots of laughter and there was lots of participation by people. And it was just a fascinating place. And I thought, I can do this. Of course, that didn't mean I was going to work any steps, get a sponsor, or do anything. I just thought I was going to sit there and drink the cheap coffee and enjoy the meetings. And finally, Big John said, no, you're going to do what we do. And he handed me a 12 by 12 and he said, it's time to start working the steps. And so I worked them. 40 minutes later, I handed him the 12 by 12 back, having worked all the steps and the traditions. And he said, no, you don't get it. That's not how we do it. And so we started on step one. And I was a knucklehead. You know, it was the beginning of me and John arguing about every step. You know, I knew I was powerless over alcohol, but I didn't think my life was unmanageable. And what John did with all sorts of patience and love was show me just how unmanageable my life had become and that I couldn't see it. So we moved on to step two, and I knew this was the step where you tricked me into your religious cult. So I was being very careful, and I didn't, besides that, I didn't believe in a higher power. I'd never really been raised in a religious manner. And I didn't think I needed to be restored to sanity. And once again, this very patient and kind man pointed out all the insane things that had occurred in my life, in the first part of my life. And then he said, you don't need to have, you know, a particular higher power. You just have to know that it's not you. And so I was one of those drunks who made the group my higher power in the beginning. And that lasted for a little bit. And then I realized, you know what, all these things I'm hearing about, the miracles in the room, they're not coincidences. They're not somebody just being lucky. They are actually something that must be divinely inspired. And there's a spiritual force at work in this world, and I wanted to connect to it. So I started trying to make that spiritual connection. I started trying to do it on a daily basis. In the beginning, my prayers were real grandiose and elaborate. However, I had an old timer tell me that he'd never known anybody to drink again who asked God to keep him sober that day and thank God that evening for another day sober. And so that's what I started doing. I do it to this day. I tell my sponsees to do it. You know, in the morning, I ask God to keep me sober today and let me do God's will. And in the evening, I thank God for another day sober and say, I hope I've done your will. We moved on to the fourth step. Well, I didn't want to do a fourth step. I didn't really want to revisit my past. But he said, if you don't do an inventory, you're probably going to drink again. And so I said, okay. And so I wrote out this big, long, elaborate inventory. I mean, it was just spectacular. It was like a screenplay or a short story. I had so much ego in it. And we sit down to do the fifth step, and he says, he said, this is incredible. And of course, I thought I was being validated. And he said, this is incredible. You're a grown man, and you've never taken responsibility for anything that's happened in your life. He handed me back all my stuff. And he said, go back through this. I want you to find your part in everything that's in here. Well, I'll tell you, there's some things that's easy to find your part. You get fired, you get divorced, you get arrested. Usually it's pretty easy to see where you fit in those kinds of situations. But there's other situations that are real discreet. And for me, real hard to find my part. But I did. And I went through and I went through and we did another fifth step. And we moved on to the six and seven. And, you know, one of the things that was a hallmark of my sobriety was I argued that many of the steps had been broken into several parts just to make the steps longer. Four and five being a couple, two and three, six and seven, definitely eight and nine for sure. And so I'd argue with him, and he said, it doesn't matter. He'd tell me the same thing every time. He'd tell me, it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter. This is how we do it. If you want what we have, you do what we do. And that was something he said to me regularly. So I had this list of defects that were in basically in three parts. It was like a menu, sort of A, B, and C. And I was going to, you know, A was the ones I was going to get rid of myself. B was the ones that, well, maybe this higher power that I wasn't really sure about would get rid of them. And C was the ones that I was never going to give up. And he told me, look, you need to start praying for willingness. Don't worry about making selections from your columns. That's not your business. You start praying to your higher power for your defects to be removed, and you see what happens. And so I started doing that. Well, now that I've been around for a while, I know my defects are removed. I get a daily reprieve based on my spiritual fitness. If my defects seem to be gone, it's because I'm doing the right things spiritually to keep that spiritual connection gone. If my defects are back, you know, and I mean really back, it's because I've let my spiritual condition lapse. I've been ignoring something. I haven't been praying. I haven't been meditating. What did I not do today that I need to do? Because my defects are back in full bloom. So that was my experience with 6 and 7. And then 8 and 9, my argument was, why should I stir up the past? Why should I stir up the past? I'm doing great. Why don't we just let things go? And he told me the same thing he told me about 4 and 5. If you don't do this, you're probably going to drink again. So I had this list from my 4-step. And of course, because I'm an alcoholic, I had all the really easy amends at the beginning of the list. And I had amends that I thought I would just never work to because I would have died of old age way down at the bottom. And of course, like a good sponsor, he just flipped the list around and had me start at the bottom and work my way to the top. Well, at the bottom was one of my ex-wives, and I had always maintained when I was drinking that, and people would bug me about it, that if I'm hurting anybody, I'm hurting myself, so mind your own business. And I didn't say it that politely. And I called her up, and she agreed to see me, which I thought was stunning. You know, why would she possibly want to see me? Well, why she wanted to see me was to let me know exactly what a jerk I was. And she did, in no uncertain terms. And when I walked away from that sort of sandblasting on the front steps of a house in Oakland, it made me realize how much my alcoholism had impacted the lives of people around me, not just the ones that I knew about that were directly connected to me, but the ones that were indirectly connected to me too. And so that started me out on a different kind of 8th and 9th step of making amends. And it came time, I know I'm getting close on the time, but it came time for some of the amends, and they were financial. And I thought, well, too bad for that. You know, the place is out of business. I don't, the guy's dead, and my sponsor said, well, why don't you pick a little charity and start sending them money until you think you've paid it back? So for some reason, my dad contributed to this Indian mission school in Ashland, Montana. And they sent you envelopes, prepaid envelopes, when you made a contribution so you could send them another contribution. And my dad handed me a fistful of envelopes. And I took them and I started making small contributions to this place because, you know, I was paying back things that couldn't be paid back otherwise. Well, needless to say, I still got envelopes right here on my desk. I still send them off. Actually, one year I was riding my motorcycle back from Sturgis and thought I'd see if there really was an Indian mission school or if it was just a P.O. box and a couple of con men. And we stopped, and indeed there was an Indian mission school and you know, 3 bikers standing in the courtyard of a mission school. It sort of put them off their game. And I was trying to explain who I was, and the guy said, oh, you're in our century club, and damned if I wasn't. And they had an honor roll, you know, and there I was, Larry Gerber. And they took us into the cafeteria. We got to eat with the kids. It was just one of the most moving experiences of my life to come out of this program. So that was my real, the zenith of my 9th step. One of the things I've learned, by the way, since I got sober is the hardest kind of amends to make are the ones you have to make for your behavior when you were sober. Because it's one thing to go and make amends for when you can blame a substance, you know, and you know, oh, you know, I wouldn't have never done that otherwise. Well, the fact is I do things based on ego and self-will that I have to make amends for. And they're really painful, and they're more painful when compared to like the amends I had to make at the beginning of my sobriety journey. The other thing I learned was the same thing I've said about the character defects, is that when I got the 9-step promises in my life, I was so happy because I really loved it. And then they wouldn't be there sometimes. And then I realized, wait, that's based on how well I'm doing in the program. That's based on my spiritual condition, just like the other things. All I get is a daily reprieve. The 11th step, I practice it every morning and every evening religiously. And then I practice praying the rest of the day just because of where I am. And believe me, this crisis, the politics, all this stuff, I pray a lot. And, you know, it works for me. It works for me to know that I have the program and the people in the rooms and a higher power, and all those things have my back. In the 12th step, I've always been in service. They told me service keeps you sober, and I believe it. And I have a friend, I don't know if he's in this meeting because I haven't looked at all the pages, but, you know, in the end of the meeting, we always say in AA, let this circle remind us we don't do this alone. And my friend says, let this square remind us that we don't do this alone. So thank you very much. I'm glad you invited me.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Larry.
Thanks, Larry. Great job.
Thank you. That was wonderful.
Great job, Larry.
Thank you, Larry. I appreciate your sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us, and continued
support. Thank you, Larry.